From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Tony Cochran's comic strip Agnes was first syndicated in 1999 and is now published in major newspapers like the Washington Post and the Columbus Dispatch. He has published two collections of Agnes comics, 2004's I'm Far Too Young to Look This Hot and 2005's I Have Tampered with the Divine Plan. He's been a celebrity guest on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me when it was taped live in Columbus and was a guest speaker at the Irma Bombeck Conference on American Humor. He's also a painter and he lives in Columbus with his wife. Welcome to Writer's Talk, Tony Cochran.
Well, thanks for having me today. Appreciate it.
Sure. Well, let's start talking about Agnes.
Okay.
And then we'll go from there. Since Agnes is about as a child, tell me about you as a kid or a youngster. I've read that you always loved to draw, but when did you start writing?
Well, the writing came probably when I, third grade or fourth grade, when actually the drawing took over me drawing small temporary tattoos of sea cows on my friend's arms and hands in grade school.
How did the sea cows?
I don't know. We just thought it was a funny word, you know. So we had started in singing class, we started substituting the word sea cow for every two-syllable word in the song and seeing how long we could get away with it before the nuns would get mad. Mm. That was my first bout with writing, injecting humor into writing.
Okay. And being punished for it, it sounds like.
We never
like
got caught.
You didn't get caught?
No, I have a remarkably innocent-looking face.
So, really?
Yeah. I did at that time, yeah.
Okay, well, I was wondering what songs that you were putting them into. Were they religious songs you were inserting sea cows into?
Well, of course they were, because that makes it even worse.
Right, okay, yeah. So sacrilegious sea cows. So you started drawing and writing and doing all this stuff as a kid and in third grade. How did that progress for you as you got older? Did you do a lot of writing in school? Was that something you really enjoyed? Or
what I enjoyed the most was the artwork. I liked to draw pictures, and I always liked to draw pictures, but I was always very good at writing, but it was never a passion. And then around the age of 16 or so, I sold my first drawing to a really sleazy biker magazine called Easy Writers, and I got $75 for my first drawing of a chopper, and it hooked me. It was like a drug. I said, well, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life, is draw sleazy bikes and sleazy women for motorcycle magazines, and my dad insisted I was going to go to college anyway, so, and I did, and so I went to the Columbus College of Art and Design. I moved up here after a year of foosball and pinball and beer at Wright State University.
Okay.
But my wife moved up here to go to school, and I missed her, so I moved up here too.
Okay. Now, I read that you've said that everything you drew until you went to the Columbus College of Art and Design looked like a cartoon.
Yes.
And then it switched for you. What was that switch, or how did it stop looking like cartoons? Because then you had a career as a painter.
Well, people had, when I went to CCAD, they ranked you on how serious you were about art. And the least serious about art were the ones whose art looked like cartoons. And consequently, I wanted to be taken seriously as an artist. And so my art took a definite non-commercial bent towards fine arts. And so did my mentality. You lose your sense of humor when you start doing fine arts. You become brooding and dark and horrible to behold. And I walked around with my artist outfit was a burgundy corduroy sport coat with patches on the sleeves, and I had if you remember Gold Circle at the time was a department store here in Columbus, and they were giving away promotional T-shirts, these real creepy looking logos on them. And I had one orange one with Bob Dylan on it. Mm-hmm. And since I was doing construction on, instead of painting, I was constructing paintings, which I thought was really out there and contributed a lot to my fine artism. Mm-hmm. I would wear a hammer on my belt, like in a little...
Just to class.
In a little hammer holster. Okay. Oh, yeah. It looked.
Was it a full-size hammer, or is this just
a
like
hammer,
a little...
Yeah, a claw hammer. You could do that then. I mean, they didn't have metal detectors at the door or anything, and nobody looked at you twice for having a hammer in a holster.
Did you whip it out during class and tap
the
on
hammer?
The desk?
Yeah.
And try to get attention?
Nope,
is that what
I just left it there as a visual device.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So this brings us up to you in college, and you become artified. And then you have a career after that as working on cars, working on body work, right?
Well, what happens they don't tell you this, they don't really specifically tell you this in art school, is he not really a lot of people breaking down the door to pay you money to do art mm-hmm. once you graduate. But I did get a good job as an apprentice in a body shop, which I worked into a full-time job in a body shop. Mm-hmm. See, I got married right around 1979, and you just want to contribute more to the marriage than a still life of grapes. I mean, you know, your wife expects you to pay.
Well, it depends on the still life with grapes. I mean, if it's a Van Gogh still life, that's a lot.
I'm talking about my paintings here. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay. No serious millions here. So.
Okay. So then you went to that, and I'd read that you would doodle on the underside of the car fenders.
Yeah, somewhere there's a 1976 Valiant, if it's not in a junkyard now, that has the actual thumbnail sketch of Picasso sitting on a beach with a naked woman, which is now a painting in my basement that I keep down there. But yeah, I was part of the fender campaign of the Velare and Aspen fenders that rusted out within 6 weeks after they were put on the car. And so they had a semi full of fenders, and I would come into work and take old fenders off and put new fenders on all day. My record was 18 fenders in one day.
Were those, I've done some body work, and on Volkswagen Beetles, they're held on by like six screws, six little bolts. Is that the same kind of thing?
No, there's 17 bolts, okay. And one of them is behind the fender well, and two of them are underneath the hood latch, so you have to take the hood off, and three more behind the headlights. So you have to pretty much disassemble the whole front end of the car to get them off.
And this influenced you as an artist then, because then I noticed there's a lot of fenders in Agnes. No,
it made me cry at night that I could make a living as an artist and get out of the body shop, is what it did. Okay. Yeah, so that's an influence.
Okay. So tell me about how you started. I thought you were going to go with the somewhere there's a fender with the first sketch of Agnes.
Oh, no.
But that happens later. I've read, you said it came to you in a notebook, and you were doing a lot of drawings in notebooks, and that's where that first arose, the character.
Yeah, Agnes started showing up. Okay, that's a whole other story, but after my career in the body shop was, I was put on hold. A good friend of mine, Chris Brumfield, developed a brain tumor and died, and I realized in some kind of a light bulb moment that you don't get forever to do what it is you're put on earth to do, or what you assume you're put on earth to do. So I decided, okay, since I'm not making any money painting part-time, well, I should probably do it full-time. Mm-hmm. That's very logical for most artists, you know.
Makes sense.
Yeah, so if you can't sell now, you need more that you can't sell. But my wife is very, very understanding, and she said, well, then, Tony, why don't you quit and paint full-time? And so I did, and that went fine for about 2 years, and I sold absolutely nothing. And I kept coming home and say, well, you know, I'm out of canvas again. Oh, I'm out of cadmium red again. And she kept dutifully writing the checks. And God bless her, I don't know why. Finally, I was down to no more paint, no more canvas. And I had left a whole stack of big pieces of paper. It looked like manila paper you used to get out of the locker when you were drawing in grade school. I mean, you did a crayon, that cheap manila paper. And I started drawing on them with charcoal. I said, you know what? These kind of look like those cartoons in The New Yorker. I said, why don't I just do those? I mean, how hard could that be? Well, it turns out later there's like five people that do cartoon for The New Yorker, and nobody else is allowed to do it. So, but I said, well, that's what I'm going
to
do.
So you haven't sold one to The New Yorker. Is that what you're getting at here?
No, this was sheer blind ambition, you know. And so I did. Didn't sell it to The New Yorker. I just did drawings that looked like it, but they didn't look quite like it. So, at the same time, there was a small, and she didn't look like this so much as she does now, but a small dark-haired girl who kept showing up in the margins of my drawings and making fun of me for being so pretentious, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was part of me talking or if Agnes actually showing up as a gift from God, I don't know. But she did start showing up. And so the cartooning thing happened from that, merged with, well, I didn't really know how to do a cartoon that looks like a New Yorker cartoon, so I wanted to get the library to get a book on how to do that. And Mort Gerberg's book, if you're interested in a career in cartooning, I highly recommend it. It outlines everything really, really well.
You recommend the book or the career in cartooning?
I do not recommend a career in cartooning. Okay. It's a great one if you get one, but if you don't, then it's just another life of sad disappointment in yourself, which is like, you know. But anyway, in the book it said, the holy grail of cartooning is to get a syndicated comic strip. And I said, okay, well, I'll do that instead, because, you know, how hard could that be?
Right.
Yeah, which turns out to be hard. there's like 3,000 submissions a year to four different syndicates, and they take like maybe three. And they launch them. Half of them are gone after a year, and the other half don't last 3 years. So it's a long shot. Had I known the odds, I probably would have never tried it, you know, because it's kind of a waste of time if somebody tells you. You know, it's like saying, you know, well, you take your last dollar and buy a lottery ticket, you know.
Right. Yeah. You could hit. Sure.
Well, anyway, I didn't know what a comic strip would look like, and I didn't know who should be in the comic strip, so I decided to use the girl who was in the margins making fun of my pretentiousness. Mm-hmm. So,
okay.
I named her Agnes because it's an old name. It's been in my family for a long time. Everybody had an Aunt Agnes or a Sister Mary Agnes or went to a St. Agnes school or something, mm-hmm. you know, so
okay.
That's where the name came from.
Now, you've got two collections
mm-hmm.
since you started.
Right.
2004 and 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Why only two collections in that amount of time? When's your third collection?
Well, I don't know. I'm trying to decide whether it's an awful lot of work to do the collections and put them together. And at the same time, I found out that the value of them goes up the less of them there are.
Really?
Yeah. So you're
charging more for this now than when you originally...
I'm not, because I don't have the books, but somebody's getting rich off of it. And I just want, you know, spread the wealth.
Okay.
If good. I had wealth, I'd spread
it. I'm glad you brought these for me today.
Yeah, sure.
They're now mine. And the value of them goes up, so that you're trading now. They're out of print? Is that what you're getting
at? They're out of print, yeah. So if you can find them, buy them. They're like gold.
Okay. So that's what's keeping you from publishing more?
No, I don't know what it is. I don't like the, if we're going to get into that, the actual monetary benefits from a deal with the publisher is not that good. And
really?
The rights of the publication are only half mine because of a contract I signed with my syndicate. So...
Okay.
Long story.
All right. Well, tell me about your work with public groups for physically and mentally challenged people, literacy development, and pet rescue. I notice you're a big supporter of all those, and I was wondering if that went in to do sort of some of the ideas behind the cartoon that seemed to be, you know, helping, like this little girl seems to be disadvantaged. She's not a lot of money in the house. And I was curious if that was something that played into those interests that I've read about of yours.
The interest I have, charitable interest or my interest in those kind of things is personal. And it's also personal to the character of Agnes, who exists for me as a very real entity. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, she's poor and disadvantaged, but she still thinks outside of herself. And what kind of things would she be interested in pursuing? You know, now I've had lots and lots of email and people telling me, wondering if Agnes herself is deficient mentally, or if she has emotional problems, or is she emotionally disturbed or anything like that, or people who write to me and say, well, I'm emotionally disturbed and I identify with your character, you know, and mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. And it's not, she's just a delicate person, you know, and the concern she has. The thing is it's really bizarre being a middle-aged guy writing through the voice of a young girl. Mm-hmm. I think that's what gives it some of its comedic bent, because, you know, obviously if I was going to talk through the voice of a young boy, it would be much more accurate, but not as funny. Because it's got another layer to pass through for it to come out. Yeah. I've always found women much more amazing than men as far as talking goes. I mean, if you get in a room full of men, like eight men in a room, very little conversation goes on. It's mostly TV turns on, you hear a beer bottle opening, and after that it's just bodily noises, and unless somebody needs to ask where the restroom is.
You're really painting a great picture.
Of men?
Of men,
yes.
Yeah,
well,
yeah,
I didn't
greens.
Say that was a bad thing. I just said it's a different thing. And that wouldn't make a very good comic strip. And besides, Calvin and Hobbes had already been done, and nobody will ever do that better. Mm. Nobody will ever do a better Charlie Brown. So I thought, well, there's room in the paper for another girl character, mm-hmm. small girl character.
Now, when I asked that question, I'm surprised that people would say, is she mentally deficient, actually? Because I had never read
deficient.
It.
I misspoke.
Okay.
Not deficient. Challenged.
Okay, because yeah. I had never read her that way, and that wasn't sort of my interest behind that question. My interest behind that was it seemed like they would arise from the same sort of hopeful way of looking at the world that I think that she embodies. She seems to have a very I think, hopeful, you know, I'm going to go try all these kind of schemes, see what I can do. I'm going to make money this way. I'm going to change and be different. And that was what was behind that.
I like the way you and I were before our hopes and dreams were beaten into submission by real life.
It's that clear that my hopes and dreams have been beaten into submission. Okay. I didn't know. I thought maybe it was just the black the jacket or something.
You're listening to Writer's Talk from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University with my guest, illustrator and author of the cartoon Agnes, Columbus resident Tony Cochran. Writer's Talk at www.writerstalk.org is a co-production of the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University and The Ohio Channel, where you can watch our interviews by either surfing to www.ohiochannel.org or by checking your cable listings for our broadcast times. You can also follow us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/writerstalk. And now, back to my discussion with Tony Cochran about the cartoon Agnes.
You responded this way to a question about the look of one of your characters. People write to me and tell me that they are Grandma. They tell me they are Trout. And you wouldn't believe how many people are running around this country who believe that they are Agnes. And they see nothing wrong with that. Yikes. I am flattered, though, that they find the characters so real and identify with them so easily. Why do you think they identify so strongly with these characters? I mean, partially, you know, that there's, you're saying, I think that it has to do with the sense of the flawedness of the character.
Right. I personally believe that everybody is flawed, and the ones who cover up the best are the ones who are the most successful in life. Okay. And so therefore, when people tell me that they identify with Agnes, it means they identify with all her flaws as well as her good traits. You pointed out many of her good traits, but she's also she talks too much, and she's not that respectful of her grandmother, except at times, because she's an actual real. I try to portray her as an actual real cartoon girl. You know, mm-hmm. she's developed to live in a 2-dimensional area. You know, mm-hmm. It's not like she's going to be ever on 3D TV or anything like that. The surprise comes from the fact that I am glad that I have made a character that people can identify with. It's not popular in a massive traditional sense. You know, it's not like, say, for instance, Charlie Brown. I mean, it was hugely popular. It's a hugely good strip, but it had a more broad appeal to a higher or a greater number of people. Agnes is kind of a bullet point to a specific group of people.
And I think that the storyline itself, I mean, all sets this kind of stuff up. There's the look of the cartoon, which is very, which isn't, I think, as intentionally sophisticated as some other cartoons. Say, Trudeau always seems to me to be looking for a really specific kind of, you know, more, not realistic, but less sort of watercolored in than this, and I mean that in a good way. You're looking at me as though you're.
No, I'm waiting for the slam.
No, I dig it. But there's also the where she lives. She lives in a trailer park, mm-hmm. and I can't think of any other cartoons that live like that. Cartoon characters that live like that.
Well, thank you very much, because she was. I'm glad that you observe the uniqueness of the strip, because it was designed that way specifically.
Right. I mean, there are other poor characters. You know, Little Abner. Everybody in there seems to be on the verge of starvation. In some ways, and I'm going to date myself here and say I remember the Cats and Jammer Kids when I was little reading old strips like that.
Isn't that a horrifying little strip? So much corporal punishment. I mean,
they were also bad little kids too.
Yeah,
well, you know, as a parent now, I can say they had it coming. No, I'm kidding. But it was. My grandparents had these strips lying around, so I've always been fascinated with cartoons. I'm fascinated with Trudeau's, with Doonesbury, and all that from a young age, which is probably partially why I'm so beaten down now. But in the same interview, you said of writing Agnes, it would be mental illness if I wasn't getting paid for this. Seriously, I need to look at things from my point of view and then Agnes's in order to distill the writing process. I write all the time, no matter where I am. I was even captured writing on the Jumbotron when I was supposed to be watching hockey. Now, I'm gonna let slide any sort of comments about what watching hockey is really all about there, but tell me about that writing process, because I'm fascinated with comic strips because they embody both the visual element, which I can't do, mm-hmm. and the words.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're at a hockey game writing Agnes, what's happening there? Are you writing out ideas for it? Are you writing out the bubbles that you then put the characters with later?
Well, okay, the writing of a comic strip is a specific rhythm. Okay, it's a, and you can almost do it with vowel sounds. And you know, the first one talks, second one talks, and you kind of get that rhythm in your head. And you know, you got like three, maybe four panels to get through to the end. Okay, it's almost like a haiku of comic writing. You know, it's like da 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 da. And then, so when you hear something in real life that you think you can fit into that rhythm, you have to get it down immediately, because I have to come up with 365 ideas a year, and I can't. I like them. I don't like to repeat myself. And so after 10 years, that's 3,000 and more ideas a year. So when I'm at a hockey game, I can never stop and relax and just enjoy the hockey game. If I hear that rhythm in my head and it makes me laugh or it makes me smile, then I have to get it down. And I think at the hockey game, they were making people sing. You know, they were making them sing on the Jumbotron or something. Some hockey fight song, or it was just ludicrous, you know, and I remember Agnes reacting to that, and I don't remember what the joke was at this time, and it wouldn't be funny if I said it now anyway, because it has to be in that rhythm and in the newspaper and in three small panels for it to be funny. But I got the rhythm and I got the joke and I had to write it down. Well, at that specific moment, they decided to turn the camera on the rabid fans enjoying the game, and I was sitting disturbously writing my strip down for the only time on a Jumbotron, and I was working. So,
Well, that shows dedication.
Or lunacy.
Or lunacy, yeah. You know, either way. So you carry around a notebook with you, and you're all constantly writing ideas for the script, mm-hmm. and that doesn't get in the way. You don't do it when you're driving.
Yeah, no, that would be irresponsible.
So
I always pull over and jot my ideas down. Yes.
So how do you develop it from there? What are you writing down? I'm curious about the act of you start off and you say, this is the idea from the script. Tell me, can you lead me through the kernel of the idea to what it then becomes? What do you write down? You just say, here's the scene. What kind of notes do you leave for yourself?
Okay, the notes I leave for myself, I write down either particularly funny turns of phrase, and I don't mean funny and ha-ha-ha funny, I mean odd. Mm-hmm. And I also I write down setups which will have a perfect answer. Okay, the first two panels are always a setup for the last panel. In the beginning stages, I tried to put the funniest thing in the second panel and then have a secondary funniest thing in the third panel, which would leave you start wanting to do the panel again, the first panel, the next day. Mm-hmm. Turned out to be too scientific for most, you know. So now I try to make the second and third panel equally funny. But I always try to get something funny in the middle panel for people who are maybe a little more inclined to delve deeper into the intellectual level of writing. Mm-hmm. And then there's always a joke or two in there, or a comedic turn for those who like a more surface level humor. And at the same time, every day I'm driving in one more nail to secure Agnes's personality, or Trout's personality, or Grandma's personality. Because what you want is you want people to visit every day. And when they do take the time to visit every day, they expect consistency, not in just your funniness, but they want consistency of character. Mm-hmm. So if I'm traveling in the world and I see something specific to Trout's character, I'll write it down. If I see something specific to Agnes's character, I'll write it down. And it's always easy to turn that into something funny, but it's not always easy to pick out a specific character point.
Okay. Like, for example, her feet, Agnes's feet, seem to me to be a specific character point. And the little thing that, the hair that comes off the top of her head, which even in a recent strip where she got all her hair cut off, there's still the little hair coming off the top of her head. So were those some of the early defined traits that you had for the character that you said, she's going to have these feet, which are noticeable, and the giant nose?
I think visually, if you're going to talk about it artistically, Agnes was designed to be to exude the vulnerableness of a young baby bird. You know, the errant piece of down coming out of the head, the long pointy feet, the round nose that's not, it's a beak, but it's not a sharp beak, you know, and the big bird, the bird eyes. I never gave her a mouth, or she has a mouth, you just don't see it, it's in the front. I don't show her from the front. So But I think she's remarkably bird-like. My wife loves birds, and consequently, I have developed a huge appreciation of birds over the years. And a baby bird is so vulnerable, you know, and so fragile. But yet, everything is there. It's just in a weird proportion. Now, as a comic strip character, I don't want to draw a Mary Worth version of Agnes, you know, a realistic small girl like that. And so you have to amplify some features to be more cartoonic, you know. I mean, balloon foot comics is what Beetle Bailey, they used to call that, because they have those big clown feet. They all have big clown feet. Well, I could have done that, but that would look ludicrous. So I just gave her the long, pointy feet. And I remember one guy telling me one time, he said, I saw her with her shoes off, and her feet are long and pointy, too. And I said, well, yeah. What did you think? They were floppy socks? And he said, yeah, I did, actually.
Okay, so you let him down with the whole sock thing.
I disappointed him, yeah.
The sock disappointment. In the few minutes that we have left, tell me about the future of cartooning. With newspapers having some difficulties now, where is it going for you? Where do you think it's going?
I think lunchboxes.
Lunchboxes?
Yeah.
Okay.
I've seen
you say a couple times that you're open for ideas of other kinds of merchandising.
Well, you know what, though? The future of comics, I think, if you want to merchandise yourself, I'm more than willing to do that. If somebody wants to merchandise, I'm more than willing to do that. I don't think that is going to actually make the future of comics any better or worse. It'll make my bank account better. Mm-hmm. But I don't think newspapers are going to disappear before I retire. And I've got enough newspapers now that I probably can do this until I retire. And then after that, it's for the young guys to figure out, you know, what are the future of comics. I don't know that the internet comics are wonderful. I enjoy reading them, but I don't know how you can make money from it. And I still make money from this. So as far as the future, if I could see it, I would have invested in Mac a long time ago or GM right after they got bailed out. I would have invested in them. I'm not prophetic that way.
Okay. Well, we will look forward to that. And the final thing I wanted to ask is, who are you watching right now in comics? Who are the people that you think are the up-and-comers?
That's hard without... I don't want to leave anybody out. But I like Cul-de-Sac. That's a good comic strip. I like the ones that are already established. I like Pearls Before Swine. I laugh in spite of myself.
In spite of yourself?
Yeah.
You don't want to because it's a competitive edge that you don't want
to... It's competitive, but it's not... He's going to a completely different fan base than I am, so I don't... Mm-hmm. I welcome him in the papers with me.
So who's going after the same fan base that you want to get rid of, Noah?
No. Nobody's after my fan base, obviously. So,
okay. And so that's Stefan Pastis and people like that. And those were here at the cartoon.
I don't think he was, but there were some people there.
Like Tom Gamble, the writer of The Doozies and things like that, we had talked to. So those are really great suggestions for what we're going to do with cartoons in the future. I'm going to invest heavily in cartoons.
Oh, yeah.
Put all your money in cartoons. I'll give you that on the way out. I've got $1.50. I've been saving for a long time. I'll put it in Agnes. And so I thank you very much for coming today, Tony Cochran, to be here on Writer's Talk.
Had a good time.
Visit writerstalk.org to learn more about my guest, Tony Cochran, the writer and illustrator of the cartoon Agnes. Writer's Talk is a co-production of the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing and the Ohio Channel, where you can watch our interviews by surfing to www.ohiochannel.org. Or, if you're in the mood for social media, visit us at www.facebook.com/writerstalk. And speaking of social media, consider attending the Free Digital Media in a Social World Conference on April 1st and 2nd, 2011, at The Ohio State University. President Gee will open the conference, followed by keynote speaker Mark Frauenfelder, former editor of Wired Magazine and current editor of the Boing Boing blog. Then we'll have 2 days of networking and learning about digital and social media. Learn more at dmsw.osu.edu. Join me next time for 10TV anchor Jerry Revish, who will describe how to write for television.
How often do things get rejected?
A lot of it has to do with timing needs for the newscast. We've got the 5, 5:30, and 6. It's a 90-minute newscast, but we've got three separate producers, and each separate newscast gets its own treatment. We don't like to repeat stories. If we're going to do something in the six that was done in the five, we want it to have a new spin, a new twist. Stories are shortened or lengthened depending on their merit. If it's a really good story, it could get 2 or 3 minutes. And in TV time, that is a long time. Because in a half-hour newscast, we've got maybe 17 minutes of content. The rest of it is commercials, weather, and sports.
I'm not going to tell the sports and weather guys you're saying they're not content. We're not going to. I won't.
Until then, this is Doug Dangler from Ohio State. Keep writing.